So how long we got? Where's our destination today?
I don't know. We got 20 miles to cover. Let's talk some movies. People don't know how to drive.
Are we going to get lunch on this gig? You seen anything good recently?
Not really. All right, we got a little time, Steve. Let's do a podcast.
Sounds good.
All right, Film Driven is back. I'm Andre Shane.
And I'm Steve Haskett.
And we're back driving around talking movies. And, Steve, it's almost the end of the year. Happy holidays to you.
And to you.
Thank you. And we're going to just kind of break down the year. Our last podcast, we talked about some of our favorites and least favorites from the summer time. But today, I think we'll just encapsulate what we like best about 2014 at the cinema.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about some of the fall releases and maybe not as much about the summer stuff since we already hit on that.
We'll just kind of start naming them off, cut to the chase, as they say in show business, Steve. One of my favorite films, hands down, 2014, was Nightcrawler, directed by Dan Gilroy. He also wrote the film. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal. Mm-hmm. Not my favorite actor. Steve,
no.
You're a fan of Jake Gyllenhaal?
Not at all.
Yeah.
There's been many a movie that I've had to get over my Gyllenhaal prejudice in order to even watch it.
Yeah. I've never been a big fan of Jake Gyllenhaal. And what's funny about Nightcrawler is that I think that movie very effectively uses the fact that a lot of people hate Jake Gyllenhaal. Because he plays a very despicable character, and he plays him very well, I must say. This is the movie where I sort of turned a corner on Jake Gyllenhaal, and I feel like, yeah, there's an actual actor there who would commit to a role. But, I mean, outside of the performance, what I really, really love about Nightcrawler is that it's a very, very sharp criticism of the media as it stands now. Now, ranking on the media and going after the news, it may not seem like the freshest approach in the world, Steve. Everybody seems to be doing it. But Nightcrawler did it in a very, very, very cool way. And the movie is just kind of advertised a little bit as some kind of almost a creepy slasher film when you see the previews for that movie. It's not really like that at all. It's really about a guy who becomes a news stringer, one of those ambulance-chasing guys who goes around with a police scanner, looks for crimes, looks for car accidents, goes films. It's a cool character study. There's a lot of humor in the film. The character Gyllenhaal plays, or Gyllenhaal, I don't know, but I never decide on a pronunciation, so I'll just alternate.
Jake.
Here, Steve.
Let's go with Jake.
Let's call him Jake. The character that Jake plays is a funny character. There's a lot of humor in the film. You kind of watch him spout his little fortune cookie wisdoms, and it's very funny. And the way he slowly kind of ingratiates himself into the world of, like, big-time news is also hilarious. There's some fun cameos in the film, some good supporting work, and the movie is just, it flows very well, it's very entertaining. It's not as dark as you would imagine it to be, and it's clearly a satire as well. So I think it pulls it off very masterfully, and this guy, Dan Gilroy, good work. It's definitely one of the best films of the year.
I have not seen that. I'm looking forward to it, despite the fact that, based on everything you've told me, Jake Gyllenhaal does not turn into either a worm or a teleporting mutant.
Yes.
Those are two strikes against it, but I'll check
it
out nonetheless.
I know, Steve. Yeah. I know. Give it a chance. You'll love to hate Jake Gyllenhaal in this movie, in a good way.
Well, a movie that I think was on both of our lists was Snowpiercer.
That's right. We talked a little about Snowpiercer for our summer review, but it's definitely a fun movie, well worth talking about. What'd you like about it?
I like that it's crazy. it's not afraid to just really let it all hang out there, and literally in the case of Tilda Swinton's teeth. But that movie's pretty wacky. It's That movie has a political component, which I think, don't think too hard about all that, because it'll just crumble in your hands. It's, you know, the deep philosophical elements of it aren't that great, but as a fun ride, it's just really entertaining.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. I mean, I think it is a very political film. It's a funny thing, but it's not one of those, you know, sloganeering films in a sense, because it kind of mocks everybody in that movie. And I always like political approaches like that. Just when you think it's going to be a left-wing film, it ends up being kind of a right-wing film, and so on and so forth. And that part is cool. It's handled pretty well. And I agree, it is a crazy movie. It's a movie that has something I really appreciate in all movies, which is kind of a sense of individuality. It has its own vibe to it. And it doesn't aim for perfection. It's not trying to amaze you with its technical achievements. It's just a movie that has a pretty straight up story to tell, and I think it's based on a manga as well, right? It's based on some kind of a comic, which of course we haven't read, but or at least I haven't. I don't want to speak for you.
No,
but,
I have not read that.
But I mean, it all kind of works pretty well, and there are surprises in the film, and some of them are genuinely surprising because it comes from kind of another cultural perspective on filmmaking. I find a lot of Asian cinema, for example, to be genuinely surprising because their narrative conventions tend to be a little bit different from ours.
Yeah, it's certainly a hybrid in that, you know, it's a Korean director making his first English language film, and there's English language stars in it you'll recognize, like Tilda Swinton and Chris Evans, of course.
John Hurt, of course.
Maybe John Hurt. Another large name that maybe if you haven't seen it, he's a bit of a surprise.
We'll yes.
leave him in there.
Yeah.
But there's also Korean actors in it.
And, absolutely.
So it's, yeah, I'm unfamiliar with the exact origins of the financing of that movie, but it really does seem like a hybrid. You know, sometimes when directors from other nations come and make American movies, you know, it's all, obviously there's sensibilities there, but, you know, like a Korean director will make if John Woo makes an American movie, there's not necessarily a lot of Asian people in the movie. And this movie really did seem like a hybrid.
Yeah,
there's certainly a large Korean component, both in the sensibility and in the casting, and it's interesting. But, I had it on my, like, top 10. It's kind of, you know, I had it at 9 to be specific. But if you haven't seen Snowpiercer, it's streaming on Netflix now. You should check it out. Not a not a kids movie. The violence is keeping with the Korean tradition of not afraid of gore.
Right. And I also want to comment just a little bit on the fact, you know, this movie stars Chris Evans, who's, of course, Captain America and has had a wonderful career in the past few years, really cooking an all-cylinder. He carries the picture very, very well, and he's very different in the film. You know, he's certainly not Steve Rogers in it, and doesn't, you know, and you kind of get to appreciate his abilities because, you know, again, his tricks seem to be completely different in this kind of role than they are in, you know, whether Captain America or the Avengers, you know, and his Marvel work and so on and so forth. So it's good to see him develop as a leading man. You know, it's pretty cool. And all the performances are actually very good in the movie. So definitely worth checking out. And you can check it out easily on Netflix, like you said.
So what else is on your list of movies you want to mention?
Well, I tell you, Steve, I kind of mentioned that I want to stay away from the bigger movies that are going to be on everybody's list, you know, and my next film is actually a documentary, or is it a documentary? It's called 20,000 Days on Earth. It's directed by a guy named Ian Forsyth and a lady named Jane Pollard, and it's ostensibly a documentary about Nick Cave, the musician who, you know, happens to be one of my favorites. I know you like him quite a bit. We've seen him a few times together. But this movie is really different because it is certainly not a straight documentary. In fact, sometimes it seems like a narrative film, and other times it seems like a concert film, and other times it seems like a straight documentary, but it's all very, very smooth. It's all very artistically done. Most of it is very classically shot, so it's shot like a narrative film, But what it does is sort of explore the world of Nick Cave. And the world of Nick Cave is actually pretty interesting. He's an interesting character. He's had an interesting life. He's had an interesting career. And he's very introspective as a man and as an artist. And he's able to kind of take a chance and delve into his psyche, his creative process, and so on and so forth. And I think even if you're not a fan of Nick Cave, this movie has something to offer you. I think it's genuinely, genuinely interesting. And I think because it is such an unusual approach at what a biography-type documentary is, I think it's really, really worth seeing because it's nothing like I've ever seen before. I've never seen this sort of approach before. And it's cool. It's really, really cool. Have you seen it, Steve?
I haven't yet. I've got it queued up to watch, but I haven't checked it out yet.
Yeah, definitely worth seeing, and I think I don't have a lot of documentaries this year, and I would definitely recommend that one.
Well, one of the big fall movies I do want to weigh in on, actually, is Gone Girl, because that movie fascinated me in that I can't tell if it's really good or really bad. To me, the key of Gone Girl is, do you take the plot of Gone Girl at face value? Because if you take it at face value, then it's just kind of pulpy trash.
Yes.
That where characters shift in really unbelievable ways. And to me, this was the problem with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, both like the book and the movie.
Yeah.
Is that, then, you know, that book's just kind of page-turnery trash. And it's entertaining, and you get into it. But there's just stuff that doesn't make sense. And, you know, as much as I can spoil anything that's been out for 8 years at this point. You know, there's a character in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo who you spend the whole book learning about how he's this really nice, thoughtful character, and then he's revealed that not only is he a murderer, but he's like a crazed Hannibal Lecter-style serial killer. And it's just
aren't
insane.
They all like that, really?
Yeah, and well, I was disappointed in David Fincher's movie of that, because I felt like he just filmed the book. You know, like yeah. David Fincher, you know, it's all done tastefully, but didn't really tweak it. And Gone Girl, you know, I've not read the book. I hear it basically keeps with the book. I mean, the author of the book wrote the screenplay.
Yeah, but I thought there was some deviation in the end. I haven't read it.
Yeah, but there's something more interesting about this story, which is that I started to get really mad about an hour into the film because I felt like I was watching a lot of effort and performances and high-quality filmmaking applied to something that just seemed like nonsense. And then when the girl of the title reveals herself, you know, about an hour and a half in, and she starts to seem like a movie. Like, I feel like I'm watching a monster movie.
Right.
But then by the end of the movie, it seems like what I've maybe been watching is a satire of marriage. And
yeah.
So I put Gone Girl pretty high up there because it's a really interesting movie to think about. And both Ben Affleck and Rosalind Pike, who play the married couple, are perfectly cast as people who are very attractive, but you kind of can't tell if are they attractive or do you just hate them? And they're both cast that way, and they both play that role excellently.
Yeah, yeah, it's sort of like Jake Gyllenhaal in Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know whether you're hating Ben Affleck or hating the character Ben Affleck plays.
That Fincher did an awesome
job. And it's a little of both, probably.
Yeah.
Fincher loves trashy stuff. He likes to take trashy material and elevate it to a level of kind of cinematic art, which is interesting. I wish he wouldn't do that every film, because I'm not sure to what extent he succeeds at it, you know, in this case. But it is interesting. It is an interesting situation, and I think it is an interesting film to talk about. I did not have it on my list as the best film of the year. But I've had some very, very interesting discussion about that movie. So it's gotta be acknowledged as a serious film, I think.
There's
no way around it.
We talked in previous episodes about the movie Under the Skin.
Right.
Which is very much an art film and that's on a lot of critics' best of lists this year. And I frankly think Gone Girl's way more interesting to talk about than Under the Skin.
There's no question about it.
There's a lot more going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can, and it is a polarizing film. Some people love it, some people hate it. And it's very intentional. You know, Fincher is a very controlled filmmaker. I mean, he is in full control of the medium. I honestly wish he would aim a little bit higher than this pulpy stuff he's been doing for the past few years.
There's a lot of people think that maybe even including The Social Network is that, you know, so everything he's done since Zodiac has been for the money.
it's starting to look that way, and yet he does bring a high level of artistry to everything he does, which is saying something.
Well, Gone Girl made a lot of money, so hopefully maybe Mr. Fincher's set for a while. He's got his new pool in or something, and he can expand his horizons a little bit.
Hopefully. Next on my list is maybe a movie that's on your list as well, and that's Alejandro González Iñárritu.
I think Iñárritu.
Sounds good. Birdman.
Birdman, yeah. We saw it together.
Yeah, we saw it together. And, you know, this is clearly an example of cinema, you know.
Sure.
It's art. It's a very artsy film. It's a film where a lot is going on. But none of it is very heavy. I think there's a lot of comedy in the film that's actually very well executed. It is, in fact, more than anything else, one of those behind the scenes of a theatrical production movies. It's not really a genre, but it's kind of a subgenre.
Yeah, the theater set comedy.
That's right, a comedy set in the theater. And this one, of course, revolves around a aging movie star who returns to the theater, to do a serious play and prove something to himself. And the catch is that the guy, played by Michael Keaton in this case, of course, was a major, like, superhero in the movies, you know? So there's that element to it. It's not strictly, of course, a superhero movie, but it's a movie that, you know, sort of plugs in into the fact that we are obsessed with superheroes right now. And we're obsessed with the genre, and here's a guy who kind of left it behind. And obviously you got sort of art imitating life, because Michael Keaton played Batman in the first couple of Batman films and then kind of walked away from the character, a very successful character, and then really has been somewhat obscure for the past few years. I don't know why. He seems to be just as good as he ever was, but the movie sort of explores his psyche, and there's just a lot going on in this film. It's difficult to really focus on one aspect. One aspect of it is certainly sort of the character study of this main character. The other aspect of it is just what's going on in the theatrical production, what's going on with the side characters. There's some wonderful work being done by the supporting cast of the film, starting with Edward Norton.
Edward Norton is fantastic.
Yeah, he's just great.
He's the loose cannon character in the film.
Yes.
Where he, you know, every scene he's in, you're never sure exactly what he's going to do.
And you're not sure whether you're going to like him or hate him in every scene. You know, that's kind of a very fun performance. And Emma Stone, who's in a lot of stuff, probably does her best work in this film. And Zach Galifianakis.
Not
used as comic relief at all. Not actually semi-serious.
And he has some funny lines, but no, he's playing a character.
Yeah, totally. Now, it's a weird movie, Birdman. Let's face it. It's not for everybody. It's not something everybody will enjoy, but I think it's just so skillfully done.
Yeah, I'm surprised that I know I've seen comments on Facebook from friends of mine who are not so much into artier films, per se, who went into it and didn't really like it. Now, you know, To me, it's not a super arty film in a way, but that said, you know, I like movies like that.
Yeah.
I adored Birdman. I thought it's one of the more exhilarating times of the movies I had all year. Because a key component about Birdman, which I'm surprised that a lot of people actually don't know, Birdman is designed to look like it's all one shot.
Yeah.
And it's, so just some really impressive filmmaking and, both in terms of the Steadicam work, and they link the shots together. You know, obviously in real life it was more than one shot, but a combination of practical effects and digital effects.
Yeah.
And all in a very seamless way.
Very seamless.
It's not, something like Rope or the Russian Ark movie.
Yeah.
Where the gimmick is the whole movie.
Yeah, like, the this gimmick is just never takes over here.
Aspect of
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And the camera almost never stops moving. So to me, it just creates a really exhilarating, exciting movie.
Yeah, it flows beautifully and it's so seamless. It's unselfconscious. It works to make the film better, but it never draws attention to itself to the point where you lose track of what's happening in the film.
And, you know, once again, with Iñárritu and Guillermo del Toro and...
Alfonso Cuarón.
The Mexicans of that generation are really, for my money, at the forefront of, like, doing interesting things.
Yeah, there's some great stuff coming out of Mexico, yeah. Again, I'm not sure how much love it's going to get at the Oscars because it is so... artsy, let's face it.
Yeah, I'm interested to see that. We'll probably do an Oscars preview, but I could see it going either way. I could see some people being put off by it, but on the other hand, I could see, you know, Hollywood loves a story about actors trying to make art, and that's kind of the subject of Birdman, so
yeah.
I could see that getting a big push, or I could see it not. We'll see where it falls.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, another exciting movie of the year, exciting viewing experience, which is actually my favorite movie of the year, Andre, was this movie called Whiplash. Premiered at Sundance as the young director's second movie. It's this movie about a college student at a very prestigious music school. He's a jazz drummer. And it's played by Miles Teller. And then our old friend J.K. Simmons plays his... really monster of a instructor. I hesitated seeing that movie for a little bit just because, I don't know, it's one of those, like, if that setup doesn't blow you away, it didn't blow me away either. Like, you know, jazz drummer at music school with an asshole teacher. I'm like, why do I want to see this movie? This movie's great. It's really, really tense, just paced excellently. And there's a lot in this movie to be said about what it takes to make great art and if it's worth it or not. Simmons is like a great villain in that he may be right. You know, he's not just an ass, like he has a point of view, and when you really consider it, there's a chance that you almost half agree with it, even if you don't agree with his methods. The other thing I loved about this movie, which was, you know, something I didn't necessarily see coming, is that the student, I'm blanking on it, the character's name now, but Miles Teller is the actor. The student is kind of crazy in his own right and goes head to head with the teacher. You know, you and I have discussed in the past, one of our big problems with There Will Be Blood is that movie is set up as a battle between two opposing forces, except in the movie, the forces are just not equal. In There Will Be Blood, as exemplified Daniel Day-Lewis versus Paul Dano, Daniel Day-Lewis just obliterates him. I mean, it's not a fair fight.
No.
Whiplash is a fair fight, and that's what makes it so exciting. And I highly, highly recommend Whiplash to anybody. If you're on the fence about it, just dive in. Great, great movie.
Honestly, to hold a screen with J.K. Simmons when J.K. Simmons is firing on all cylinders is hard. So to say that this kid, who was very young, early 20s, right,
yeah,
to be able to hold the screen with that guy, that's a huge, huge compliment in my opinion. So, I mean, it seems like a fantastic film. I can't wait to see it myself.
What else you got, Andre?
I'm going to have to go with Boyhood here, one of the best films of the year.
It's also on my list. Yes.
On, you know, on many critics' lists, this is Richard Linklater, kind of an experimental film in a sense that it was shot over a period of about 12 years. It follows a kid from the time he's, well, how old is he at the beginning? Like 9 or something like that?
No, I think he's like 6.
So it literally follows him from being a little kid to basically being an adult.
His entire public school life.
Yeah, and I'm not really aware of any other fictional film, narrative fiction, that has done that, has achieved that, and achieved that in a way that's so subtle and so seamless and so non-forced. You know, you expect this movie to be sort of the greatest hits of growing up. Oh, it's his first beer. Oh, he loses his virginity. Oh, he falls in love. The movie is not like that. The movie really, really chronicles various events in this kid's life that on the surface don't seem that important. But when you look at them in a whole picture sense of what a life is, you realize how things that are maybe not that important seeming at the time end up being critical events in your life. The performances are great across the board. Ethan Hawke plays the dad, and he has a really, really interesting story arc. I mean, you think he's sort of one kind of guy at the beginning. He ends up being another sort of guy. Patricia Arquette, who's kind of hit or miss for me throughout her career, is amazing in this
film. She is fantastic in this movie. I really hope she gets nominated. And she was fantastic for 12 years.
Yeah, that's exactly the thing. I mean, we are not talking about a performance when an actor has to deliver a role within a period of a couple of weeks, which is how it happens on most films, certainly most smaller films. I mean, we are talking about creating a consistent character over a decade of time. This is almost unheard of outside of television, and television people do it, but, you know, in television, people go to work in the morning, come back in the evening. It's almost like a corporate job, you know, when you're doing a TV show. But in this case, every year or so, she would go back to this character and continue living in the space for that character until that portion of the filming was done. And this went on for over a decade. That must be extremely difficult from an intellectual perspective for an actor. It's certainly difficult to pull off as a director. And I really think Richard Linklater deserves an enormous amount of credit for pulling this off. I mean, the movie is seamless. It doesn't feel like 12 different movies.
It's not just a collection of scenes that have been thrown together. That's maybe the most impressive thing about it, is it does feel like a coherent film.
It does.
And, you know, it's weird. I never quite know, like, as much as the listings matter, I put it at 3 on my list, but Boyhood is a very hard film to talk about. It's just impossible to separate the achievement from the movie.
Right.
You just can't. So, in terms of how you evaluate it, you know, you also have to really, you know, a lot of times it's interesting to talk about the backstories of movies, but I do try to separate it. I try to, like, because the only thing that matters is, like, what's up there on the screen.
Right.
And if what's up there on the screen is good, then it's interesting to talk into, like, how they did it. You know, what went into making this good thing I saw.
Right.
But, you know, it's wrong to just talk about, like, if a movie's not good or flawed, it doesn't matter how great the story behind its creation is.
Exactly.
But Boyhood, you really just can't. You cannot separate the two things.
Well, you can, because the creation is solid. So then you sort of have to come back to, like, wow, this was very, very difficult to pull off, and Richard Linklater pulled it off.
And he did. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's no way, it certainly was difficult. But he did it, I guess, the right way, in that every year he would edit what he had before. So especially by the time he gets to the latter years, you know, he had 2/3 of a film complete. And Richard Linklater, who knows what he's doing, is able to then craft scenes that, all right, where do I go from here?
Right. He thought about it. It's not just point a camera. I mean, it was thought out, but it was also,
like you said, it's not like he wrote a complete script during the first year of filming, and then they just checked off the boxes
and
as they went along.
Yeah, he himself aged. In the process of making this film. He himself developed as a filmmaker in the process.
He directed multiple movies.
Multiple movies of different genres, multiple movies that were completely different from one another while he was working on Boyhood. So there's an element of his own autobiographical maturity throughout the course of this picture that really should be taken into consideration as well. And, you know, kudos must also be given to the kid. He lucked out. There's an element of luck.
Yeah.
That kid could have lost interest after a few years. Instead, that kid developed into a pretty good actor by the time he's an adult in the movie.
No, the kid is great.
And that works. So there's and I like the element of luck in art. I think that's an important aspect in any artistic endeavor. So in this movie, he got lucky. Like, the gods of the cinematic arts were with Richard Linklater. And I really hope this movie does well in the award season as well. Because it really, really is... It has its peaks and valleys. I'm not going to say every moment of the film is fascinating and amazingly engaging, but the movie overall is very affecting and very profound in its sort of outlook on what it is to grow up, not just as a child, but to grow up as an adult, because the adults in this movie also develop, and that's really, really one of the most affecting aspects of that picture, is how the grown-ups grow up. And as an adult myself and as a parent myself, that really, really struck a chord with me. And I really, really appreciate that he was able to pull that off in a cinematic sort of confines, because that's very, very difficult. I mean, it's almost never done. It's so difficult, you know? And
And Ethan Hawke is another one of those actors who... the character he plays in this movie kind of mirrors my feelings about Ethan Hawke, which is that I didn't hate him the way I dislike Jake Gyllenhaal, but I often felt with Ethan Hawke as a young man, he didn't impress me all that much. I thought he was overly serious, and he seemed like a guy you'd meet in college who would, like, play his guitar a lot and want to talk to you about philosophy, but didn't really have anything interesting to say. But then as he got older... You know, I started to like him better. Like, you know, Ethan Hawke is the mid-40s ex-asshole is a more interesting actor to me.
Yeah.
And that's the character he plays in this film, is that he plays a guy who in his 20s and early 30s is maybe doesn't really have his shit together and kind of causes a lot of trouble for people around him. And then as he gets older, he kind of... puts it together a little bit more, and you wound up having a lot of affection for this guy.
Yeah, he's very good in the film, and you know, again, Boyhood, clearly one of the best films of the year, if not the best. What's next on your list?
Well, we've covered most of the ones on the list. You know, we both really like the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Loved it, absolutely. One of my favorite Wes Anderson films, honestly. I think it, I mean, he really kind of brings it all together here. It's got the humor, it's got the pathos, it's got the cuteness. You know, it's a very sort of cute, miniaturized world that he's created once again. Certainly, probably his most stylized world that he's created up to this point. I mean, this movie takes place in a fantasy.
The only reason I wouldn't agree with that is just because, I mean...
Outside of Mr. Fox.
Well... I just mean to say it's the most stylized Wes Anderson movie is maybe splitting hairs as opposed to that.
But you know what I mean. There's a world there. It's different. Yeah. Like you could say, like, Royal Tenenbaums still takes place in a recognizable New York City, you know, even though it's definitely still an alternate.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this movie takes place in a complete fairyland. I mean, it may as well be set in the Magic Kingdom of Disney World, you know.
Yeah.
But this movie gets... It digs a little bit deeper, I think, than most films by Wes Anderson, and really succeeds very well. I mean, it just works. I found parts of it affecting. I found parts of it very funny. I think Ralph Fiennes is an excellent comedic actor.
Oh, that's what it did. There's a couple actors who always do dramas who occasionally in public appearances exhibit a sly side that
right.
you wish. And one of them was Ralph Fiennes.
Ralph
like
Fiennes,
over the year, I've been like, man, can Ralph Fiennes do a comedy somewhere? And, you know, he's for years and years, it was all, you know, either The English Patient or in the vein of, you know, like Ralph Fiennes.
Right.
And so finally, somebody puts Ralph Fiennes in an out and out comedic role. I mean, and he's great. He's fabulous.
Yeah, he's absolutely great. He's a real revelation. I tell you, these British actors, you know, you gotta give them props. I mean, these guys can do so much because of that classical training, you know.
Yeah.
And Ralph Fiennes is clearly like a prime example of that. I mean, he was a guy that people were like dying to put in a box you know, after his first film, which was Schindler's List, in which he played one of the most sadistic scumbags in the history of the cinema. And to see him do this sweet, kind of noble character who's at the same time a complete weasel, too, you know? And that's hard to pull off for an actor, and it's hard to pull off for a director. And if you're a fan of Wes Anderson and you missed Grand Budapest Hotel, you have to see it because you will love it, I think.
Yeah. It's...
Well, I mean, not everybody's a fan of Wes Anderson. I mean, he's definitely
I don't know if this would sway you. Yeah,
I don't know if it'll
sway you. About him, if it would change your mind.
Well, I mean, it's almost a hyper Wes Anderson movie, right?
But it's good Wes Anderson, and I liked it a lot better, say, than Moonrise Kingdom, which was something I found, you know, fairly charming on first viewing, but then watching it again, it's... just seem kind of minor.
Yeah.
And I
it grew on me. I don't want to argue about Moonrise Kingdom. I think Moonrise Kingdom is fine. And I did actually, it grew on me in subsequent viewings. I thought it was minor on the first one, and then I liked it better. But regardless of that, I mean, I think Grand Budapest Hotel is in the top three Wes Anderson movies ever made. And that's saying something, because he's actually been... fairly consistent.
Yeah.
You know, if you're into what he does, you will love this film.
Sure.
It's that simple. And moving right along, my next favorite film of the year is a small film called Cheap Thrills. It's directed by E.L. Katz, who I think co-wrote it. It stars Pat Healy and Ethan Embry. And this is the epitome of low-budget filmmaking. And one of the things I want to do in this particular podcast, Steve, is I want to get away from the big movies that everybody's going to talk about. Because, you know, what's the point of us plugging Captain America the Winter Soldier? I mean, it's good. I loved it. But I kind of want to talk about the smaller films, and Cheap Thrills is a prime example. I mean, it's a movie with such a small budget. When you watch it, it's almost jarring, because it kind of makes you realize the degree to which low-budget cinema has disappeared in the past 10 years. I mean, there are virtually no low-budget movies being made that are being seen by anybody, you know? And this movie is really, really cool. It's got one of those... it's a concept, you know, the concept being how far will you go for money. Very simple concept. And it deals with these two buddies who meet in a bar after a few years, one married with a family, the other one is kind of a drifter. Then they meet another guy. That guy is played by the great David Koechner. Is that how you pronounce his name?
I'm not sure.
The Anchorman series. You know him as a comedian. He's a hilarious guy, bald guy, big dude, very funny in everything he's done, excellent comedian. He goes dark in this movie, and he goes dark like only comedians can go dark. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, comedians have a tendency, like when they play bad, you know, and there's a quality to comedians, an edge to comedians that allows this to happen. And David Koechner definitely knocks it out of the ballpark, and so do Ethan Embry and Pat Healy. Both of those guys deliver fantastic performances. Their characters, it's one of those movies where characters go through changes. You think you know what the character is like, but by the end of the movie, that character is completely different than what you thought they were. And I really don't want to reveal much more about Cheap Thrills, but I will say this. If you like solid, well-done films, and you want to support films like that, that's a movie to support. It's friggin' excellent. Really, really check it out if you get a chance.
Well, I want to mention a movie I saw called Happy Christmas. It was my first Joe Swanberg movie,
uh-huh.
A Chicago director. Also my first movie of what you might call mumblecore. Joe Swanberg, if people aren't familiar with his methods, he shoots fast and cheap to the extent that he averages 2 to 3 movies a year. And part of how he does this is that the script exists in terms of their scenes. But similar to like a Christopher Guest movie or a Judd Apatow movie, there's like kind of the situation set up, but the dialogue isn't carved in stone. He just puts the actors there and lets them ad-lib the dialogue.
Yeah.
Now,
pseudo-improvise.
You know, to be fair, when I described this to my wife, she said, that sounds kind of lazy. And maybe it is. So Happy Christmas came out the same year as another movie made called Drinking Buddies, which I haven't seen, and which is supposed to be better. But I watched in the Christmas season. It's about this family. There's people in their like late 20s, early 30s who have a baby, and the sister of the brother comes to stay with them over the holidays. She had just like broken up with her boyfriend and is kind of looking to get away. And there's tensions about, you know, what it's like to be a partying girl in your late 20s, trying to live in the same house with a baby. The pros of Happy Christmas, I was surprised, is that it's really well edited. Like, Joe Swanberg knows when to get out of the scene.
You know, it's rare quality.
Yeah, so it's about 90 minutes long, and that is something he shares with Christopher Guest, that he presumably had, like, a lot of footage, a lot of ad-libbed footage, and things felt like they ended at the right time. Now, that said, it's, you know, it's just a simple relationship movie. One of the things, Andre, just purely on aesthetics that drives me crazy is, again, that movie, it just looks like shit. And I don't understand that even on a low-budget movie, now, he shot on film, so which I find odd that for somebody who prides himself on not spending a lot of money and just like, bam, bam, on to the next one, why you would take the time, like, that's his one stickler thing, and that might affect some of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like if you and I and two friends lit a movie, it would look better than this movie.
Yeah, possibly.
So, yeah, Happy Christmas. It was an interesting foray into that genre. I basically liked it, but I'd like Joe Swanberg to kind of beef up his aesthetics a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, and that's another thing. You know, the film purists, like, I appreciate them, but when you know, there's a difference between Christopher Nolan, the film purist, who's got millions of dollars and makes film look great, and Joe Swanberg, the film purist, who just can't afford to make film look great. And that's really the difference. The reason digital has taken over in the past few years is because you can make digital look phenomenal on a very low budget without having to worry about color grading and all kinds of stuff that goes into every celluloid film production. So I really would not recommend being a film purist to low-budget filmmakers. It seems like a wrong way to spend your budget to me. I think you could probably do it better. But what can we say? Joe Swanberg is a fairly successful independent filmmaker. And, you know, maybe he knows what he's doing. But I do like the fact that we're giving props to these Chicago area filmmakers. Both Pat Healy and Joe Swanberg have Chicago roots. I tell you, it's good to see independent films again. I mean, really, really like low budget films where there's an auteur behind it all, where it has something to say, and it doesn't have a bunch of superheroes, and it's not, you know, explosion spectacle based stuff where it's actually about humans being humans. That goes a long way for me, and I appreciate it, and I think people should check out both of these kind of movies. You know, I think it's important to keep these low budget fit cinema experiments and various other stuff going. I think it's very, very important to have movies like that. And that actually brings me to my favorite movie of the year, which is a movie out of Great Britain called Locke. L-O-C-K-E. And Locke is written and directed by Stephen Knight, a guy who amazingly is the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which means that he's a millionaire many times over. And lately he's gotten into film and television production, and he's just friggin' great at it. I have to give him props because I've been watching a television series that he's created on Netflix. I absolutely love it. It's called Peaky Blinders, and he wrote and produced that series. And Locke is a movie that stars one of the actors from that show, one of our favorites, of course, big star Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
Tom Hardy, very versatile actor.
Extremely,
and
yeah.
Very different in this movie. He plays a lot of kind of these slow burn type characters, extremely violent men. Not in this film. He plays a very regular Joe in this movie, an architect. And the entire film takes place in his car as he's driving from work.
And I've always liked movies that are kind of structured as a one-man or two-man plays. I like that kind of limitation when filmmakers sort of create a little, you know, sandbox for themselves and just play within that sandbox. I've always appreciated when that is well executed. And in this movie, it's really well executed. I mean, it's only about 86 minutes long, so it's a very tight film. The script is very tight. And it's not one of those movies where somebody's holding his daughter hostage or anything like that. The stuff that happens to the main character, whose name's Locke, in the film is kind of pseudo-pedestrian, nothing amazing. He's having troubles at work. His co-workers are letting him down. He's in the middle of launching a huge construction project that he's invested all his time in. He's having troubles at home. He's having issues with his mistress. There's a lot going on in his life, and all of this is playing out in the car while he's talking on the phone. And at the same time, he's working out the issues he has internally. So he's having these internal dialogues on top of the fact that he's kind of talking to his Bluetooth phone device. I think anybody who's had a crisis while driving home from work will identify with this film. Uh-huh. But I think, you know, when you put a guy like Tom Hardy with a good script and a good director like Stephen Knight in this kind of a milieu, the results are either going to suck or they're going to be great. And I think in this case, they're great. Locke is an excellent film. My number one film of the year. My favorite. You should see it because it's on Netflix now.
Well, I want to mention a couple things that are technically 2013 releases that I caught up with that I really liked. One is a movie called Blue Caprice, which is it's about the Washington, D.C. sniper story, which, if you recall, happened not that long after 9/11. And, you know, it's a story of this older man and this teenage boy who wound up just killing random people mm-hmm. by shooting them from the back of a car. Mm-hmm. Blue Caprice, I mean, it's that story. That is a story. But it's told very much like an art film. And it's a sad story about how this teenager who kind of, you know, was pretty neglected. He came from Jamaica, I believe, as a Caribbean. And he fell under the spell of this guy named John Muhammad, who was kind of quietly, you know, a sociopath. And how this older man, because he was the only one who showed this kid any interest and affection, was able to really just kind of brainwash this kid into becoming just a cold, unfeeling killer. It's a fascinating, terrifying movie. Very well done. It's not exploitative, you know, it doesn't glorify, you know, it is that story, but it also isn't where it doesn't excuse their behavior or anything like that. But I highly recommend Blue Caprice. You should check that out.
I heard good things about it. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, along the same lines, there's been a few films that are, I wouldn't put them on my best list, but I found them really, really good and really enjoyed them. And I kind of want to just give them a little heads up there. One of these films is Get On Up, which is a biopic about James Brown. Godfather of Soul, Soul Brother Number One, hardest working man in show business, the man with the most nicknames in show business.
Yeah.
You know, modern music owes such a huge debt to James Brown. I mean, it's impossible to describe even the amount of influence he's had on what modern music is, for better or worse, in all honesty. But, and on top of that, James Brown is a very complicated figure. You know, he's had some very, there's a lot of good in that guy and a lot of bad in that guy. So it would be very, very difficult to do a biopic that kind of does him justice. I'm not sure whether Get On Up does him justice, but I will say it is an exhilarating biopic. I really, really enjoyed the film's musical performances. I thought Chadwick Boseman, who's a real, real, I mean, he's already great, and he's just going to get greater and greater as he gets older. He's a terrific actor. The movie's structured in an interesting way. The movie does not glorify James Brown's wackiness. It doesn't glorify his abuse of women, his crazy drug intake, his violent streak. It treats him as a human. And it treats him as a very interesting and complex human. It's a very good film. If you get a chance to check out Get On Up,
definitely check it out. I think especially if you're a fan of James Brown, and by golly, you should be. Get On Up is a great way to sort of find out about where that misunderstood genius James Brown comes from. And another weird movie also having to do with the music industry is a movie called Frank, directed by Lenny Abramson. And this is that weird movie. Some of you may have heard of it. It's basically Michael Fassbender is the star of it, but you won't really recognize him because throughout the entire film, his character wears a giant papier-mâché head over his head.
Sure.
And boy, I almost don't know how to describe this film because it is so quirky, but and it's hard to even describe what exactly the film is about until you get to the very end of the film. So you kind of got to stick with it. Obviously, you're in pretty weird territory when you're talking about a movie where a character wears a big papier-mâché head over his head. But
it's based on a true story.
It is amazingly based on a true story. And I don't know how to what extent the movie follows that story or just uses as a kind of a jumping off point. But the movie is very interesting. And Michael Fassbender amazingly does give a pretty affecting performance in the film, considering that his face is covered the whole movie. The movie also kind of gets into some interesting dynamics of how musical groups function together, what affects creativity, why some bands, for example, go through periods of incredible creativity and then lose it and never regain that creativity ever again. It touches on all of that stuff, and it touches on you know, interpersonal relationships and stuff. It's about a lot of stuff. It's not about one thing per se, but the movie is weird. And I like weird. I'm at the point where I want to see weird stuff that's successfully done as opposed to just seeing standard stuff that's successfully done. Frank definitely does it.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. I've been curious about that movie. I'm familiar, the guy who I think wrote the screenplay and who certainly wrote the book that the story's based on is a guy named John Ronson, who I'm familiar with his work for This American Life, and he's a really interesting guy. If you ever hear him read his own stories, he's got a kind of unique cadence as well. John Ronson was in real life, played keyboards in a band with the Frank person.
Yeah, very interesting film, and, you know, it's got funny parts, it's got non-funny parts. It's one of those movies that covers a surprising amount of ground. A couple of films that I sort of view as well, let's call them guilty pleasures.
Okay.
There's a movie called The Salvation, which is a Western out of Denmark. That's right, a Danish Western. Would that make it a meatball Western? I'm not sure what the Danish, like if Italian Westerns are spaghetti, this would be, well, let's call it meatball.
Yeah.
Or maybe herring.
They have good coffee in Denmark.
Well, God bless. They got some very talented people in Denmark. And this movie stars one of my favorite Danes, Mads Mikkelsen, who is just great in everything, who, of course, has his own TV show called Hannibal right now, which is also one of the best shows on TV that I highly recommend. But The Salvation is a straight-up Western. It's not a revisionist Western. It's very, very straight-up. What makes it Danish is the fact that the main characters are in the film are Danish immigrants who travel in the Old West and deal with what the Old West has to offer him. Mads is fantastic in the film. Ava Green gives a purely silent performance. If you're a fan of Ava Green, and I am, she's great in the film. Doesn't utter a word. And there's a physical reason she doesn't utter a word. But she is great. And the villain in the movie is played by Jeffrey Dean Morgan from Watchmen and various other films. And he's a terrific villain. I mean, he is a straight-up classic Western bad guy. You love to hate him, but he's really cool at the same time. So that is a fun, fun Western with good action that's satisfying. And again, it doesn't try to reinvent the Western genre. It just tries to do it real, real good from a slightly different viewpoint. And that's always fun, especially when it's well executed. Now, when we get into the real guilty pleasures, I would say Dracula Untold is a movie that you should see, Steve. Dracula Untold. Yes.
I've not been told that before.
Yes, yes. Dracula Untold is it's a silly movie, Steve. It's a movie that kind of tries to create the origin story of Dracula based on real event. Obviously, Dracula was a real character. He was a Wallachian prince. Although in this movie they make him a Transylvanian prince, but close enough. Yeah. The real Dracula's claim to fame was not vampirism, but was in fact that he was a very fierce warrior. And Vlad Dracula, to this day, is the hero of Romania because he stopped the forces of the Caliphate, the Islamic invaders that were taking over Europe at the time. He was one of the noblemen who stopped them from conquering essentially all of Europe. So to this day, there are statues to Vlad Dracula, but the rest of us know him as a monster because he certainly got pretty damn extreme in his methods. And then he kind of turned on his own people. In other words, he lost his mind. Somewhere out there, there's a really, really good, genuine biofilm to make about Vlad Dracula. This is not it. Uh-huh. This is the story of Vlad Dracula, the vampire. And it's pretty fun, not overwrought too much. It's got a lot of silly shit in it. It starts Luke Evans, who's kind of an up-and-coming young leading man, and he's very good in the film. He carries it beautifully, and he's fairly convincing as Dracula, both when he is the good guy and when he goes dark. So if you're in a mood for some brainless fun that may still teach you something, Dracula Untold is worth checking out. Decent beat picture.
I want to give a little shout out to every Halloween I try to watch some horror movies and see if I can find at least one good one, a keeper.
Uh-huh.
And this year I stumbled upon a movie from 2013 called We Are What We Are, about a family of cannibals. I found out it's actually a remake of a Mexican film, which I have not seen. But this is kind of more well-regarded than the Mexican film, so maybe they improved upon it. It's directed by a young director named Jim Mickles, made a couple other movies. It kind of combines, you know, the cannibal element is there, and there is gore, but it also talks about an abusive father and what it's like to have kind of a backwoods, strange religious family around. Part of the ways the cannibal family is able to keep it under wraps is because they're kind of regarded as the religious nuts in the town. So everybody kind of gives them a wide berth and just, you know, lets them do what they're going to do. And
which is chowing some human flesh, apparently.
Yeah. Well, after I saw it, I went and read some of the backstory is that the director really liked this other movie called Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. There's three M names that came out a year before, which is really great. It's a really great movie, a small independent film about a cult.
Yeah.
And this, so he wanted to kind
of that film before.
Yeah, he kind of wanted to take a that atmosphere and make a horror movie about it. And it's just really well done. It's really a horror movie that makes you think and is scary and does have a little bit of gore. And so if you're looking for just a well-done horror film, by all means, check out We Are What We Are.
Yeah, and that same director did the movie Cold in July that came out last year with Michael C. Hall, right, and Don Johnson. And that's actually kind of a fun genre movie, too. It's certainly not a horror film, but it's more, it feels like it was based on, or loosely based on, a true story from the 80s. It takes place in the 80s. Michael C. Hall is very good in it. He carries it very well. It's a story of, like, kind of an average guy whose house gets burglarized, and he ends up killing the burglar, and that sort of leads him on his own investigation into what happened, and he sort of uncovers various cover-ups and blah, 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 and gets a couple of people to help him. It's an interesting film. I enjoyed it. It's not great, but it's, again, one of those lower-budget films that's really worth seeing and worth supporting. And that's my message this year. 2014, Steve, I want to just push the low-budget films. That's what I want to do. Is that all right?
Yeah. I like them as well.
Excellent. Well, that's all I got today, buddy.
Yeah, that's, you know, we'll probably do a little Oscars preview podcast in a month or so and talk about those things. And, of course, there's a bunch of movies always at the end of the year that, you know, we haven't seen. We'll have to catch up later. I mean, chief among them on my list. There's Inherent Vice, the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie.
Can't wait to see that.
Not even out in Chicago yet. And Mr. Turner, who, you know, we haven't discussed a lot, but Mike Lee is one of my all-time favorite directors.
Yeah.
And so the new Mike Lee movie is always worth checking out in my book.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. All right, Steve, well, that's all for this edition of Film Driven. I'm Andre Shane.
I'm Steve Askin. We'll see you next time.
Let's go.